So Michael, thank you, first of all, for your generosity. I know this is the end of a long day of exchange.
Believe me, there's no generosity involved.
It's the top of the iceberg. So I guess that my role here is to introduce in our discussion an invisible guest. That's why there is the empty chair. So there is this is cinema. And in a nutshell, my Ur question, I think, will be, does cinema and modernism, the other side, do they cope together or do they struggle? But to be a little bit more explicit, I have a few minutes. I have 4-5 sets of questions divided in two parts. So the first on your 1967 art and objecthood, and the second on your more recent scholarship, and I know that where cinema surface again. So in the first essay, so 1967, there is a brief, keen, and it's frequently quoted passage on cinema. Movies are here conceived in a dialectical relationship with theater, and I'm reading for the benefit of everybody, the quote. So it is the overcoming of theater the modernism sensibility finds most exalting, and that it experiences as the hallmark of high art in our time. There is, however, one art that, by its very nature, escapes theater entirely, the movies. This helps explain why movies in general, including frankly appealing ones, are acceptable to modernist sensibility, whereas all but the most successful painting, sculpture, music, and poetry is not. Because cinema escapes theater, automatically, as it were, it provides a welcome and absorbing refuge to sensibilities at war with theater and theatricality. At the same time, the automatic guaranteed character of the refuge, more accurately, the fact that what is provided is a refuge from theater and not a triumph over it, absorption, not conviction, means that the cinema, even at its most experimental, is not a modernist art. And so consequently, in a footnote in the same essay, you acknowledge the complexity of this issue and you suggest a phenomenology of cinema that would clarify its specificity in regard to theater, but maybe also to painting. So I read again, exactly how the movies escape theater is a difficult question, and there is no doubt but that a phenomenology of the cinema that concentrated on the similarities and differences between it and stage cinema, that in the movies the actors are not physically present, the film itself is projected away from us, and the screen is not experienced as a kind of object existing in a specific physical relation to us, would be rewarding. So you establish a radical opposition between theater and cinema, but also between cinema and modernism. In an attempt to escape theater, finally theater risk to be theatrical. So I guess in my first set of question is, if you discuss at the time your views on cinema with your friend and colleague Stanley Cavell, that at the same time was working on not on a phenomenology but on an ontology of cinema that was not divorced from
not quite
modernism.
Yet in 67. The movies books a little later. Yeah,
71. Yeah.
Yeah. But the point's well taken, right?
So I could move to the second question on the other question on
sure,
your
sure.
first.
Move yeah. To, yeah. To, on, to all the questions.
It's also on the same essay. So at the end, Art and Objecthood doesn't give more details on this phenomenology of cinema. However, you quote extensively Tony Smith's suggestive recollection of a night drive in New Jersey in 1951. So it's the other quote I'm not reading. It's quite known. It's on the screen. And I just read like the first sentence. It was a dark night. There were no lights or shoulder markers, lines, railings, or anything at all except the dark pavement moving through the landscape of the flats rimmed by hills in the distance, but punctuated by stacks, towers, fume, and colored light. This drive was a revealing experience, and so on and so on. So there are several ways of considering this trip in the darkness. Voyage, au bout de la nuit. So according to your interpretation, what's Tony Smith was has been revealed by this night car ride would be like the pictorial nature of painting. even one may say the conventional nature of art. So I'm quoting. So moreover, this was also the quintessential theatrical experience. One which, and I quote again, the theatrical character of literalist art, only without the object, that is, without the art itself. So here, what is at stake is so the literalist or the minimalist hostility toward art. However, what today, as a scholar like working on abstract art but interested in cinema, what strikes me or is here that is right is as an intrinsic cinematic aspect. Inside his car and through the windshield of this car, Smith sees the landscape that is unfolding before his eyes, like a movie that is projected on a multiple screen, as in the coeval expanded cinema experience. And the setting, so the car and the night and the TNT's road in an American landscape, to me evokes also like the road movies that at the time were reach its nihilistic peak, as in, to make just a couple of examples, like Easy Rider 69 or Vanishing Point 71. So my second question would be, if retrospectively, you refute the Tony Smith's nocturne experience for his theatricality or also for his cinematographic nature.
So
that would be my first on the 67 essay.
Okay. So should we stop there, or do you want to say the others
as
too?
You
give all the questions.
Okay.
Yeah.
Between
us, we'll remember.
Okay. I would like to consider your more recent scholarship on contemporary art and moving image are like much present, although not as film but as video. And there are at least three different moments. I mean, there are more. I'm just like selecting three. In each case, that's my interest. I mean, this is like interesting. There is like a slight shift, decalage to what is currently the cinematographic experience. So the first one is Jeff Wall, that it doesn't talk about cinema, but about cinematography. And here the cinema is combined no more with theater, as it was the case in your 67 essay, but is combined with photography, so with another medium. The other, photography in a book where we learn why photography matters as art as never before. In the second example is Ludwig Wittgenstein. So you evoked his anecdote, which I think is correct that since the end of the 30s, Wittgenstein went often to the movies, especially Western or frankly bad movies with happy endings, and that he insisted on sitting in the very first row of seats, so not as in a penny, but as close as you might be, as the cinéphile in Paris in the. The 60s, being totally absorbed and rarely taking his eyes off the screen. And that at the point of whispering to his friend, this is like a shower bath. And interesting, the following day, Wittgenstein couldn't remember any detail of the movie he just saw. The last example is Douglas Gordon from your more recent Four Honest Outlaws. And here, especially on Deja Vu, so 2000. Gordon has a strange-like position, because on one side, he considers cinema is dead, basically. I mean, there is also like a quote in your essay.
Douglas Gordon, yeah.
Douglas Gordon. Is dead as a narrative structure. And on the other hand, the avant-garde films have no audience at all. And video for Douglas Gordon looks like an in-between, or maybe I would say an alternative medium, if it is a medium, that defies classical cinema, making the movie opaque. And actually, I like because you use opaque as a verb. You say actually that Gordon's video opaques the movie. So the question, how will you consider this passage from painting, mostly painting and sculpture, to a video, do you still hold the same views today on cinema or video change your take on cinema as a medium, as an aesthetic experience, if not a modernist art? How you would consider today the relationship between cinema and modernism? And finally, does cinema that is the quintessential modernist 20th century experience for plays a role in modernism, or it has still to be measured, let's say, measured within the medium of paintings? And it looks like there is an unresolvable relationship between modernism and cinema, and an unfortunate one if we just think of the catastrophic consequences, I mean, the impact that the wonderful Hans Namuth documentary on Jackson Pollock had on his personal, I mean, on his personal and on his artistic life. So I insist on cinema for several reasons, and I mean, just name a few one. Going back to 1948, so Clement Greenberg write Byzantine Parallels. And here is discussing the shift from cubism to a more ambiguous impressionistic flatness. And he's talking about Newman, Rothko, and Pollock as steel. And here is the quote. They attempt to expel every reminiscence of sculptural illusion by creating a counter-illusion of light alone, a counter-illusion which consists in the, and here is my emphasis, projection of an indeterminate surface of warm and luminous color in front of the actual painted surface. This new kind of modernist picture, like the Byzantine gold and glass mosaic, come forward, and again is my emphasis, to fill the space between itself and the spectator with its radiance. And it goes on. So, and interestingly, Greenberg, I mean, that's the only quote I found, he mentioned cinema just apropos Bonnard. He said that Bonnard painting resembled screens or panels more than easel paintings. So the fourth question would be, isn't that, I mean, I should like ask this question to Clement Greenberg as well, but isn't that colored light projection on a surface is a device that is typically, if not specifically, cinematographic, more than pictorial, more, and wouldn't cinema be a better fit here than the impressionist residual that we find in color field painting? Or could we think about a color screen a color screen influence behind the color field painting? And so last question, if I would like to move backward in history and go back to your scholarship on Diderot, and I found another cinematic reference in your writings, and I think to Diderot comment on the Fragonard, Les Grands Prêtres Corysius se sacrifie pour sauver Caliroué, so 1765, and here you write, there is an obvious affinity between, no, it's just the painting, I'm just reading, affinity between Diderot's account of the projection of speaking colored image on a screen, an idea doubtless extrapolated from his acquaintance with magic lanterns and the modern cinema. And you find other affinities in Diderot's use of the fiction of dreaming, his description of his physical immobilization in the cave, and his characterization of the projected image as phantom. So my fifth and final question would be, if maybe screen and tableau have very close, I mean, they share the same history, or maybe that we have to go back, that the screen, that this phenomenology of cinema goes back to a phenomenology of the tableau that you retrace in through Diderot. Thank you.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I'm going to make one tiny little point, because I read this, you know, when it was sent to me. I'm going to make one tiny little point, which I think is a correction, but which this is not meant in any way to deflate the total argument. When Greenberg says that thing about Bonnard and screens, he's not talking about movie screens. He's talking about something like Japanese folding screens. He's talking about the way in which the Nabi, you know, work on screens in that sense. So it just doesn't cut towards movies. I mean, that takes nothing away from the larger point of what you're saying, but that's what he means by screens there. So, yeah, so I wrote that paragraph. And even when I wrote that paragraph, you know, I realized that I, something essentially insane about it. You know, movies are not a modernist art, period, right? At a moment when 67 already Godard is functioning in the world and, you know, all sorts of things are happening. But so, and when it, there's a sense in which what I'm saying about movies is much more a statement about, let's call it ordinary narrative film, okay? Almost like the Hollywood film. You know, traditional diegesis and so on and so forth. The response to which is, you know, unlike what the way in which one even then would encounter a movie like Two or Three Things I Know About Her or, you know, various other movies of the period. You don't just simply sit there in the dark and forget yourself and give yourself up to a narrative experience. Godard's clearly unsettling that, and so are other filmmakers through that period. But I did want to say something. There was a sense in which that the conditions of ordinary narrative film, and I would have to, yeah, I would want to make certain, I say, even, including even appalling ones, but the exception would be any film that had Richard Burton, because he was so theatrical that, you know, he could wreck anything. And there were, you know, there have always been a handful of actors and actresses who could just should just be kept out of movies completely. But fundamentally, movies seem to me, you know, not to be theatrical, right? Their issue wasn't going to be one of, by and large, of theatricality. That wasn't going to be the condition of their failure. But at the same time, I'm just now repeating myself, it wasn't because they defeated theater. There was something about, to use Cavell's phrase, the ontology of film, that simply escaped theater, avoided the issue, provided some, I call it absorption, but let's call it a certain kind of immersion, a self-forgetting. You're in a dark room, you forget yourself, you give yourself up to the narrative, and so all the things that, and this is spelled out by, you know, just lots of film theorists like Victor Perkins and others. It's an unproblematic, you know, thing to say. What struck me about it is that it completely avoided the issue of, I mean, the good news is it's not theatrical. The bad news with respect to the modernist problematic, as I was trying to define it, is it didn't defeat theatricality. It found a way not to have to deal with theatricality at all. That was just part of the, let's call it the automatism, the mechanism, the ontology of film. That's the claim. Did I talk about this with Cavell? Cavell and I saw each other in these years like multiple times a week. We talked about everything. We showed, each of us showed the other every single page or paragraph that the other wrote. I mean, we were from 1963 on, from 63, we were just joined at the hip, right? We just did, we completely interpenetrated, okay? Now, he wrote the film book not in Cambridge. He was in Middletown, Connecticut at Wesleyan University, so it's not as if we had talked that thing through. But as you know, in that book, he alludes, you know, he has a whole, the excursus on modernist painting, extremely generous things to say in that book and also in, let's say, the Lear essay in Must We Mean What We Say about art and objecthood and other things and the whole issue of defeating theater. So, and the notion of presentness that we both shared, notions of acknowledgement, which we both shared. This was just truly joint stuff, you know? And so, you know, he wouldn't have had a problem with that claim. I mean, and he certainly read that claim. You know, I assure you, he read, you know, as I said, we each read everything that the other was doing. So Cavell didn't have a stake, and you know, it's an interesting fact about The World Viewed, which is a great, great book, The World Viewed and More of The World Viewed, but it basically finesses anything that you could call modernism in painting in a certain way, and it finds a way largely, let's say, to finesse Godard, among other things. I mean, Cavell admires Truffaut, and, you know, let's say Jules et Jim maybe above all, but he's not really comfortable with Godard. I would say the book in many ways, I mean, it makes a kind of modernist claim in saying would count as a modernist gesture would have to be something like the camera tipping its hand, right? I mean, there's a suggestion of that. But there's no exact suggestion of how, what this exactly would mean. Presumably, it would have to mean something like breaking the force of the diegesis in some way, you know? But he doesn't, it's not, this really isn't a set of issues that Cavell ever engages with. You could say Cavell never really goes into the question of modernism in film. We have that book, and then we have the great essays that go into the Comedies of Remarriage book, and even greater essays, in my view, that go into Contesting Tears. Truly stupendous essays. But modernism isn't really his topic in any of those books. But did we talk about this stuff? Yeah, absolutely. The Tony Smith, your reading of the Tony Smith is very interesting. I mean, I have to say, it just never remotely occurred to me. And also, if I think of, you know, him being in the car and what it's like to be in a car rushing, it doesn't feel to me exactly, it doesn't exactly feel cinematic, you know, because it's, but I don't want to, I don't have an argument there. I just think that's a really interesting thing to think about. And it certainly never crossed my mind.
I actually mentioned his cinema experience because it looks like Matisse painting, where he paints a landscape through the windshield of a car, and you can see like the three screens and a painting on the wheel.
But it's that thing feels so stable. It feels so it doesn't feel unrushing in that way. You know, for me, the part of the essence of the Smith experience, as he describes it, has to do with the sense in which I'm talking about the temporal structure of the theatrical as being a going on and on and on and on. And so this is a kind of, you know, literalization of the going on and on and on. And what is revealed in going on and on is as the sort of temporal mode of literalism, let's say. And then what gets revealed for him, which is so perfect, is, you know, sort of like the conventional nature of all art. Right. So we're just going to have, let's say, from looked at one point of view, just objects. Looked at from the other point of view, we're just going to have experience. Right? We're going to have just the experience without the object. And the two things sort of are just the other two sides of the same thing. So then the larger question of, let's say, the relation to my more recent work. Well, what happened for me, which was completely unexpected, I mean, If you're an art critic, if you write criticism, and I'm an art historian, I'm an art critic, if you write art criticism, people think, they seriously think that you don't want to like things. They seriously think that you want to go through the entire rest of your life saying, nah, it's all just crap. And that's deeply satisfying, right? Instead, what you're going through, I just want to see something that I can believe in again. You know, the greatest moment of my life around art was, contemporary art, was for a very long time seeing Caro's Midday in his courtyard at night, you know, and being hit by lightning. That's what you want. You crave it. You crave conviction. You crave belief. You can't give it away for nothing, right? You can't just convince yourself, but you're looking for, one day I'm in New York, right? And I am passing, is it Gagosian? I think so. And I go up and I walk into the space and there's two big screens at right angles to one another in a dark space, and there's an elephant being projected on the screen. There's these translucent screens, and the elephant is taking a few steps this way and then goes a few steps this way and it lies down. And the first thought I have looking at the elephant is, an elephant. But I stayed about a minute or two. By the end of a minute or two, I didn't want to go, so I stayed. And so that's how I got to see Douglas Gordon's Play Dead real time. And I left that, you know, I spent like a whole afternoon just watching this elephant on those screens. You know, two screens and a little TV monitor with loops, different loops on both screens. I left like totally convinced that I'd been, you know, wiped out by a really significant work of art. And I mean, there was nothing that had prepared me for Douglas Gordon, right? And I hadn't seen 24 Hour Psycho at that point, but you know, if someone had told me about 24 Hour Psycho, I'd have felt again something like that. And then I saw more. I think Gordon's some kind of genius. Okay, I think 24 Hour Psycho is totally stunning. And I just love the simplicity of it, you know, just the simplicity of the dispositif, right? Play Dead Real Time is fantastic. Deja Vu, which you mentioned, is amazing. Most of you here probably have never seen Deja Vu or read about Deja Vu. Deja Vu is a work, but it's really exemplary of what it would mean to use film to make a modernist work. Right. And by the way, you were saying video. You know, I no longer know what to call any of this stuff that we're talking about, because in many cases it's filmed on regular film. You know, it's filmed on, and then it might be put on video to aid the editing and so on and so forth. But a lot of the work we're talking about is not video. It's something like, by and large, short contemporary art film. There's no easy medium designation. I was just in London, and I caught the last day of Pierre Huyghe's exhibition there. And he showed a 19-minute film, which he calls Human Mask. And it's complete knockout work of art, okay? Just totally stunning, okay? So, but Deja Vu, Douglas Gordon does the following. He takes a film, the noir film from the early 1950s, DOA, Dead on Arrival, starring Edmund O'Brien. And he projects it three times onto a wall alongside each other with the soundtracks running. But with this brilliant intervention, the projection in the middle goes at a standard 24 frames per second. The one next to it goes at 23 frames a second. The one the other side of it goes at 25 frames a second. So they start out together, and then as they run, they start to separate. If you come into this exhibition, as you're probably going to do, 15 minutes or 20 minutes or 40 minutes or an hour into the film, you don't know what's going on. You're aware that it's the same film. You are not going to pick up that. You're aware that repetitions are starting. That something that happened here is going to also happen. You don't know what the soundtracks are mixed, so you're getting the mixture of the soundtracks, and you don't understand whether you can't. No one's so smart that just looking at this thing 20 minutes into the film that they can decode the structure. But you're seeing this, and they're interfering with each other, but they're also repeating each other, and you're constantly getting hooked. You're aware that this guy is incredibly upset because he's swallowed some radioactive poison that's going to kill him in 24 hours. And he's trying to figure out what's going on. And he's talking into a phone and he's saying, Paula, listen to me, Paula. And he's running through the street and he's confronting doctors. And suddenly he's running through the street and he's confronting doctors. He's yelling to Paula. And you get caught up here and then you sort of pull out of it. And I realized this is a work of genius. Okay, what he's done is take an absolutely traditional film, one which, projected under normal circumstances in a dark movie theater, gives you the full immersive narrative experience. And he's moved it out of that situation into an art gallery experience. You're not sitting down in a dark room. You're standing up. You're conscious every minute of yourself, your bodily separation from the works. You're again and again being drawn into little bits of the narrative, little bits of the diegesis. And then you're being booted out by the incoherences, by the repetitions, and so on and so forth. So you could say, and I think I do say that what he does is opaque the film. But here's the further stroke of genius. So you could say that what he's done is take a normal, immersive Hollywood film and turn it into something like a theatricalized artifact, which is keeping you at a distance. But then you become aware of something else. You become aware of, so it's lost its normal diegetic pull, right? You can't enter it, lose yourself, just go with it. You're going to have these little moments of I'm with it for a tiny bit. He's running through the street. He's really up. But you're aware of something else. You become aware of something else. You become aware of the incredible effort, and you might say absorption, of O'Brien and the others in the project of acting, of movie acting, and so on. So, Paula, listen to me. You're aware there is no Paul at the other end of that phone. Right? He's holding a dead phone. It's just a prop. But he's giving it 100% as he... And it's very important that it be O'Brien, that it's not some very, very famous movie star. So you're not involved in the normal kind of, you know, recognition of stars. In other words, what you're made to see is the total absorption, the total commitment of all the different actors in the project of creating, as it were, the illusion of the diegesis. So he's done this stunning thing. He's theatricalized it and overcome the theatricalization by shifting the locus of the absorption. So, I mean, this is just a tiny thing. Another time I went to see a Jeff Wall exhibition at Marion Goodman. And as I was leaving, I looked in a side room. And in the side room, there was a screen. And there was a black man with dreadlocks blowing into the mouthpiece of a saxophone under strange circumstances, producing kind of weird, weird sounds. And the camera sort of in his face like that. And again, I had this moment of saying, oh. But there was something about it, I stayed. It was Henri Salla's Long Sorrow, 13-minute film, utter, total masterpiece in my view. Okay, I think Henri Salla, who has just turned 40, is maybe the most interesting 40-year-old artist in the universe right now, in any, you know, visual medium. So for me, one of the great surprises, I mean, after the great surprise of discovering large-scale art photography 15 years after everybody else, there was like the further phase of a surprise, which was just now being blown away. And so I've written a lot about this. And I've written again and again about Salla, Gordon. Gordon, a great movie about a violinist and a violist playing Mozart's Sinfonia Concertante called Kirchhoff K364, A Journey by Train. And then in the photography book, Zidane, which Jean-Pierre and I went together to see the first moment it was released in Paris. And I think we were both like totally stunned by it. I saw it again that day. So one of the big surprises for me has been, you know, how terrific, I think this is something new. I think these developments in whatever we want to call this medium, pick up on an earlier phase. There's been a whole earlier phase of avant-garde working with film from Warhol and so on and others. But this is something new. Suddenly it's being used by Gordon, Salla, stop motion film by Thomas Demand. Philippe Perrino, Pierre Huyghe. It's being used in a new way. And I think I want to say, this may be my upset, but I think it's being used to anti-theatrical ends. I think presentness turns it. It turns out to be the case. I mean, no, there's no notion in art and objecthood that's more important than presentness. But presentness, you could say, is operating there metaphorically. It's as if the Morris Lewis unfurled is just revealed to you. Suddenly, it turns out that through these durational, temporal, this art form, an almost more powerful effect of something like presentness, of the world being, you know, established every split second as you look at it can be done. And I think this is just a fabulous body of work. And for me, it's been a total revelation and, you know, completely unexpected.